I will go around and greet people and then do some announcements. So, starting with Sandy and Shoketsu, Amanda, Sam, Mark W, Bob K, Jim, Paulette, Mary, Joan, John, Phil, Laura, Bruce, Charlesley. I'm just guessing that's your name and not just your. Okay. Candace, Tara, Pat, and Amelia.
Good morning.
Morning. And Shoketsu? Yes. I think you might have had your audio off when I greeted you first. let's see. Did I miss anyone else? All right. Let's see. So, I actually prepared some stuff to paste into the chat in terms of our announcements. There's next week is our Rohatsu retreat. Next Sunday will be a normal meeting, so you can ignore Rohatsu retreat if you want entirely. But there is a link to the info for our retreat, which is going to be all on Zoom. There's also a link to the retreat schedule. And then I also put in a link there for our to our overall event calendar, so you can see that we are going to go on holiday break between December 22nd and January 1st. So that means we miss two Tuesdays and just one Sunday meeting. And yeah, and if you want to just drop in and participate in our Rohatsu retreat schedule, you are very welcome to. It's the same Zoom, same password. If you want to commit to part of it and let me know, I'm going to be there these days, or in order to kind of reinforce your own intention, you're welcome to register for the retreat and let me know in that process. So I think, is there any other announcements anyone can think of or any questions anybody has?
Book group. When is it? I forgot.
All right. So December 19th is the term student closing retreat and the book group. the book group will be meeting at a different Zoom. So if you are interested in that, you can email me or in the newsletter when there's an announcement about it. I think, Mary, did they put your email in that announcement for the
They have in the past, but I haven't looked at it recently enough to remember if it's still there.
Yeah, I think it's
Yes.
probably still included in
Yeah.
the book group announcement in our weekly email newsletter. All right. Well, so today's Dharma talk is essentially part two of what I'm calling Each One of Us Has Unique Bodhisattva Gifts to Offer. So I did a Dharma talk on this 2 weeks ago where I introduced the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is a very ancient, influential, very curious Mahayana sutra from about the first or second centuries AD. And I read parts of it and I talked about how it ends with a very long, hundreds of pages chapter, the 39th chapter, which is a story called The Entry into the Realm of Reality, where a young boy goes, he wants to learn how to be a bodhisattva, and he ends up going on a journey to learn from bodhisattvas, and they tell him what they do, what their gifts are, but then they say, but you know who you should really talk to? And then they send him on to the next bodhisattva. So he ends up going to 53 different bodhisattvas. So I've also done a podcast episode on this, and I'll do a podcast, another, at least one podcast episode on this, because it ends up being, there's some really rich material here. So 2 weeks ago, I just kind of introduced the Avatamsaka Sutra and listed like 17 different bodhisattva gifts. But this week, I want to go over a number of these bodhisattvas that Sudana, the boy, visits in more detail and reflect on their gifts and what these gifts might, how we might interpret them, because the sutra naturally has this kind of flowery, grand, kind of supernatural imagery and language, and you know, but most of these can be like, what does this symbolize, or what does this mean? How would this manifest in our lives? So I was thinking about going over those in more detail, and also taking advantage, because, you know, those of you who listen to the podcast will get this in another form, but in the Dharma Talk setting, what I figured I would do is, after I talk about a particular bodhisattva and read a little section of the sutra which describes their attainment, their gift, their talent, and I suggest perhaps the ways that this might manifest in the real world, that I would pause for a little period of time, 30 seconds or so, long enough so it feels, you know, somewhat spacious, where we can reflect on the gift just described. We can reflect on whether we recognize it in ourselves or others. Does this gift, talent, or insight manifest in you? Does it manifest perhaps in someone you know? The way that I'm going to be phrasing it is, I'm going to be asking, do you, you know, and inviting you to reflect and think about certain aspects of character, certain strengths, certain interests. I'm going to ask in terms of you, but you may end up thinking about somebody else. Does this manifest in someone you know or someone you admire? But also reflecting on, what ways might this bodhisattva gift manifest? What other ways might it manifest besides the ones that I brainstormed? So, you know, certainly if something in the sutra imagery makes you think of something else, that may occur to you. And also, are you used to seeing this particular gift, this particular manifestation, as a gift that is of something of value that can be shared to benefit others? So some of the things that we're going to be talking about today, you may or may not, you know, because oftentimes when we think of a bodhisattva, we think there's certain things, you know, certain bodhisattvas can do what we expect, right? They give away a lot of gifts, or they help people realize the Dharma or something like that. But there's other ways that other bodhisattva gifts. So we can reflect on whether we're used to seeing this particular manifestation as a gift of something of value to benefit others. And perhaps if it manifests in you, is it something you value and cultivate, or is it something that you tend to dismiss as a gift? So sometimes that's a situation as well, which I talked about at the end of my last podcast, that sometimes we don't recognize our own gifts or appreciate our own gifts. So those are the kinds of things that you might want to be reflecting on as we go. And when I pause after we talk about a particular bodhisattva, if you think of something you want to say, please, you know, go ahead and unmute yourself and say something. And if you don't particularly feel comfortable, sometimes it's a little awkward on Zoom, like jumping in, you're welcome to write in the chat, just write comment or question or something like that. And then like, I'll see that it's coming from your name. So I'll know who would like to say something. So if you feel more comfortable jumping in that way, I'll call on you. So that way we take advantage of this Dharma talk setting to maybe take some time. So I have quite a list of bodhisattvas to go through, so we'll have plenty to cover our time today. But if we want to take some time to discuss them more as we go, that would be lovely. So starting with the monk Magashri, who sees the Buddhas in all the lands in the universe. So in the Avatamsaka Sutra, so Sudana is this boy who's sent off on this journey by the Bodhisattva Manjushri. And he Magashri is the first person he visits. And Magashri explains what he has attained, what he has been able to do as a bodhisattva. He says he's able to see the Buddhas in all the lands of the 10 directions. That is, in the east, I see one Buddha, two Buddhas, three Buddhas, 100 Buddhas, 1,000 Buddhas, 100,000 Buddhas, 1,000,000 Buddhas, 100,000,000 Buddhas, 1,000,000,000 Buddhas, 100,000,000,000 Buddhas, 1,000,000,000,000 Buddhas. I see incalculable, immeasurable, uncountable, inconceivable, incomparable, incomprehensible, unlimited, ungraspable, inestimable, unutterable numbers of Buddhas. I see as many Buddhas as atoms in this continent. So, as I talked about 2 weeks ago, the Avatamsaka Sutra seems to have been written in a way to blow our minds. Like, it just is a kind of poetic, meditative text that just keeps on kind of expanding your mental imagery. So at first glance, this attainment of Magashri, you know, may seem okay. I mean, he attained some super, you know, insight, some supernatural ability to see all these Buddhas. You know, what good is that? What good is that as a bodhisattva gift? But if we reflect, this is a deep and transformative insight that monk Magashri has, not just into the possibility and reality of awakening in this lifetime, spiritual liberation in this lifetime, in this world that we know, but somehow an insight into how this possibility of enlightenment appears throughout the universe in every direction. You know, just permeates the universe. There is nowhere it does not go. So imagine the attitude and manner of someone with this kind of perspective, this great faith and patience and spiritual perspective, which would naturally end up being communicated to the people around them. So do you, or someone you know, do you naturally have a broad perspective and faith that you and others will always find a way? Do you have the ability to see the potential in every situation? Do you have a deep conviction that the universe is an amazing and beautiful place? How might others benefit from these natural perspectives or abilities? Maybe you express them directly or in artistic expression. More likely, you simply manifest that sense of the world, that sense of the universe in a more subtle way by being maybe steady and patient and positive. So we'll just leave some time there to reflect on this Bodhisattva gift. And if anyone has anything to say, please feel free.
Domyo, it's Joan. I guess I'm not following today. This Bodhisattva who could see all the 10 directions and da da da, and he could see a million this and that and that. And then are you asking us what kind of Bodhisattva gifts we have to bring? I don't get the connection between the two.
Well, I'm going to go over a list of a whole bunch of different Bodhisattvas who have different kinds of gifts. So as we go through each Bodhisattva, we might just, does that remind you of anyone? Does this particular Bodhisattva's gift, do you resonate with it? Do you think you have any of that gift? Or do you know anyone that you think has manifested that kind of gift? So we're kind of reflecting on each type of gift, not so much on, and it may be about what you have or what you resonate with. But rather than kind of like taking stock of what Bodhisattva gifts we have, we're kind of letting our imaginations be stimulated by reflecting on these different Bodhisattvas. So that's one of the things that I think is really useful about the Avatamsaka Sutra and this and really Dharma teachings in general, in a way, is on Tuesday evenings we're reading a book by Norman Fisher where he talks about the importance of imagination. So in a way, you might think ideals are also about imagination, about us kind of like, wow, what does that look like? How does that manifest? And then, because I think a lot of times when we reflect on what kind of Bodhisattva, gifts or talents or callings that we have, sometimes our imaginations are limited. Sometimes we just think, well, I guess I'm pretty friendly to people in the grocery store. I'm not mean. I try to be nice to my friends. Which is all great stuff. But like sometimes our imaginations are limited in terms of what kind of gifts we or the other people around us might have. So does that?
Yeah, it's just I can't help feeling that he was showing off. What you just who needs to brag that they can see all of this stuff? But maybe I'm not interpreting him properly.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of the flavor of the sutra. So first of all, Sudana does go ask, right? So he's not just sitting there bragging about being able to see all the Buddhas. Sudana is this boy who's going around and he says, I really want to learn how to be a Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva Manjushri sent me to you to ask how I do this. So, I mean, he is being asked to explain what it is that he's attained. So that maybe that helps.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts or reflections? So this is the next teacher that Sudana visits, but eventually I'm not necessarily going to do everyone. This is the monk Sagara Mega, who uses the universal discriminating eye. So when asked by Sudana, he explains that he has attained the universal eye, quote, revealing the practice of enlightening beings, showing the differentiation of the planes of all universes, showing the spheres of all truths together, the light purifying all lands, dispersing all challengers, crushing all demons and devils, making all beings happy, illumining the hidden recesses of all beings' minds, communicating to all beings in accord with their mentalities, illuminating the turning of the wheels of the senses of all beings, end quote. So previously, Maghashri had this vision of universal enlightenment, right? Could see Buddhas and Buddhahood throughout the universe. So Maghashri's vision is different. Maghashri's has a discerning, discriminating intelligence, being able to tell the difference between things, which is also very necessary, right? Clearly discerning the differences between what is causing harm, what is helpful, adapting one's approach based on the carefully discerned capabilities and character, whoever you're dealing with. So when I was reflecting on, and this is like, you know, again, the grand sutra in this kind of language presents this as there's one bodhisattva that has all these amazing abilities. But I think for, you know, for our purposes, it's like the important thing is the abilities, and each one of us just might have like one of those abilities, right? Not all of them, but it's just a, you know, a device in a way to say, you know, here are some bodhisattva gifts. They just, you know, there's one person has this amazing ability, has all of them. But so some of the questions that I came up with is, when I thought about this particular kind of gift, is do you have a natural intelligence and concern causing you to look deeply at things, to discern what's really going on? Do you feel compelled to understand so that you can solve problems for beings and see their lives go more smoothly? If you encounter an obstacle, whether it's physical or technical or having to do with effective communication or teaching, when you encounter an obstacle, do you become even more determined to overcome it? So I'll just pause there. Give us 30 seconds to reflect and or chime in.
There's a certain amount of resonance there. Does this bodhisattva have anything useful to say about paralysis by analysis?
Unfortunately, I don't think it gets quite that practical.
That's the bodhisattva of overthinking.
But in some ways, if we embrace that that intention or that drive in ourselves to understand, if we embrace that as a bodhisattva gift and we realize, all right, what I'm doing here is trying to, you know, relieve points of discomfort for beings, to solve something so life goes more smoothly for people, then it gives it a certain perspective that might give it a different context, right? Because I know for myself, I might get fixated on a particular problem and lose track of why I'm doing it. So it becomes a compulsion in and of itself and not helpful. When originally it came, you know, I was drawn to it for a good reason.
Yeah, there's something to recognizing all of the infinite variety of things. How to put it? You can't have harmony without lots of notes, right? So recognizing the differences of all of the notes is a prerequisite for creating a harmony. Mm-hmm.
This is Amelia.
It's interesting. I was thinking of, I have this tendency, I think maybe part of it was the way that when I was working as an attorney, part of my job was solving intellectual problems. I was an attorney for the state legislature, and so we got all the hard questions that nobody knew the answer to, and then we had to think of a way to write up a law that would take, you know, and so sort of those logical puzzles really became part of my, not my life's work, but my work. And I think I still find meaning in those sorts of challenges and the way that I help people. And some of my friends have called me a karma yogini because I enjoy being able to help them find a used couch, or helping them sort out their social security problems, or you know, whatever it might be. There's an intellectual satisfaction to it, but there's also a deep, usually, I mean, it depends on, you know, who, what the situation is, but quite often there's a very deep, there's a deep emotional satisfaction, but also a real spiritual component to it when it's done in the spirit of service and not just, yes, only I can fix it, which I confess I come off that way to my siblings more often than not, or my son. Just let me do it for you. I'll do it. I'll handle it. And, you know, that sort of tendency. But when it's done in a spirit of service and really, really trying to be a part of the solution and even to suss out what is going on, there's something deeply fulfilling about it and deeply just the feeling of being engaged in the world in a positive way. And I think especially now living alone and being in lockdown and all of that, it feels like a very healthy connection. So, and that's why, I mean, during the political campaigns, I volunteered to do voter assistance on a hotline, which was satisfying on a lot of levels, but it felt like a very positive way of engaging in the world. So, yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. It occurs to me that this is, you know, another way to kind of stimulate our exploration of this in terms of our own bodhisattva gifts, is like, how can you make a difference in the world?
Yeah.
You know, what, yeah. How do you tend to make a difference in the world? How are you, you know, what are your abilities to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. And you, in your experience, and especially when it's a more sort of esoteric quest or something, you're exploring it on all these different levels and these kind of introspective things of like, well, am I just trying to feel important? Oh no, it's fine. Just do it. And you know, all these little conversations you have with yourself. But like I said, I think what I find is when I feel like I'm really doing something in a spirit of service.
And I think that's, you know, in some ways there's that, this overarching question in this exploration of what's the value of seeing any of these things as bodhisattva service specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you might do them anyway, right? You might have your skills and talents and abilities, but to really, I think there's some value to trying to identify and recognize some of these activities or strengths or gifts as bodhisattva service, because we're perhaps more likely to cultivate them, we're more likely to cultivate our gifts if we recognize, oh, that's actually something I have to offer people. And we're also, I think it dignifies the activity, you know, like,
yes,
I'm a organizer. You want something organized, I'll organize it for you. The communication, the logistics, the physical stuff, like I'll organize the heck out of it. And it's kind of just a compulsion in a way, you know? It's a skill, it's an interest, it's a talent, it's a compulsion, whatever. But if I recognize, you know, it kind of dignifies it. If I realize, oh, you know, that is something I can offer in this situation. But also then I think in another context, you know, just as Sudana in the Avatamsaka Sutra is going from bodhisattva to bodhisattva. And even though they have these superpowers, right? They say, but you know, I only know a little bit. So you should go talk to that bodhisattva. And in a way then we can, if we recognize, all right, you know, I have these bodhisattva gifts, but I don't really have that bodhisattva gift. And right now it kind of seems like that bodhisattva gift is called for. So I know for myself, I like that problem solving, organizing aspect. But, you know, I have to be really conscious sometimes when a friend comes to me and they don't want that. They just want me to be there. They just want me to listen. And it's hard. It's hard for me. I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, I got some suggestions. Oh, what? You just want me to listen? And, you know, so maybe, I don't know, you do your best, but maybe in some ways it's like, you know who you should talk to.
Yeah, that's the hardest part, is knowing when to just stand down. So my son would say sometimes, Mom, stand down. Got it. Thanks. Stand down. That's hard.
All right. Any last comments about our universal discriminating eye?
So Mio, I have a comment or question. I'm not sure what it is. So I have my mom is actually dealing with dementia, and my sister has been taking care of her, and it's getting to the point where she is, and I don't know if this is, maybe this is not the greatest time to bring this up, but she's been taking care of her for a long time, and my mother's getting to the point where she is psychotic, really. Mm-hmm. And so when does it get to, like, I feel like there's a fine line between being a bodhisattva and understanding when something's beyond your ability to help anymore. You know, it's like, how do you decipher if it's something you're doing out of kindness or it's something you're doing out of pride or like sheer will of maybe denial, or, you know, when do you, how do you, because for me, it's always been, this is beyond my ability to manage. And for her, it's been, well, I am doing this. This is what I need to do. You know, she's also older. So she's the oldest child. And in a lot of Asian families, that's like chonan. So she's got the responsibility of caring for the elderly parents. So it's complicated, but the idea is that when it almost feels like there's a willful denial versus a helping, you know, when does it get to that point where it's no longer helping, but it's actually, willfully, I don't know if I can, ignorant is kind of a rough word, but like not willing to accept, the reality of the situation.
Wow, that is a rich topic that we could spend a lot of time on that. I mean, I think basically, you know, the answer is that that practice has no answer to that, but it gives us the tools to explore those questions with some equanimity and clarity, you know, and inspires us to ask that, you know, for it even to occur to us to go, you know, is this helping, and what else is involved here, and to explore that, that's part of the practice and part of the process. And sometimes, you know, in our stillness of zazen, or, you know, as we're chanting, or as somebody else in the sangha says something, there'll be a little shift and we'll go like, yeah. You know, so I imagine even you're sharing today, you know, just there's been some other people here who just weren't like, yeah, I mean, you know, some similar question arising, some similar koan arising. But the basic teachings around it are that when the bodhisattva is really doing bodhisattva, like, not, this is the ideal, right? This is the imagination ideal. When the bodhisattva is really doing bodhisattva work, there is no sense of I am doing this for that person. There's just a lack of separation. There's a natural, compassionate, appropriate response, right? So we're going to encounter a bodhisattva later who actually, their bodhisattva strength is drawing the line. Their bodhisattva strength is scaring people into good behavior. So, I mean, if you use your imagination, there's like, you could imagine a bodhisattva who is like the bodhisattva of difficult duties, who just, you know, goes into all the grim kind of duties and doesn't lose their strength and fortitude. And that's what they do. That's their special gift. So in this case, I don't know, you know, maybe what else could you give to this situation that might not be that? Is one thing that occurs to me. I don't know if any other people have any thoughts, or go ahead, Paula.
No, I just want to say thank you.
Good, rich discussion.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do bodhisattvas not suffer from doubt anymore?
Well, the ideal, right? I mean, that's where, like, if, you know, the ideals of the bodhisattva or the Buddha or perfect generosity or whatever. I mean, I really just love this idea that Norman Fisher, you know, introduced us to in his book of the necessity of imagination. Because I've always been really intrigued by ideals, but also it's kind of a love-hate relationship. It's like, but we never measure up to ideals, so what good are they? Like, what relationship do they have to ordinary human life? But if I think of them as just their way of opening up that possibility in our mind. So I can imagine someone who is free from doubt. I can imagine someone who, and I can certainly, I know people, I've experienced being freer from doubt, right? So if that ideal is holding, you know, is like at the far end of the spectrum, we can witness moving from a lot of doubt to less doubt, to feeling more authentic and centered and in our groove, perhaps, so we can have more confidence that the responses that are coming out of us are the best ones that we have available. Does that start getting at what you're talking about?
Kind of. I have an offer to make. I don't think anybody will want to take this up, but
the offer is, if you want to meet the Bodhisattva of great anxiety, come and see me.
Well, with that, let's go on to another Bodhisattva. So, this is, looks like we'll only get to like 3, and I got 10 on my list already. So clearly this is going to be able to be we'll revisit the series at some point. So this is Monk Supratishtita, who has attained a light of knowledge called ultimate non-obstruction. He says, whereby I am free from obstruction in awareness of the mental actions of all sentient beings.
We came in to see if you wanted to walk with us.
Comprehension of time divisions as being conceptual and in non-corporeal pervasion of the Buddha fields in the 10 directions, all by the attainment of non-being, non-abiding, and non-doing. This kind of speaks to the whole no doubt freely functioning thing. By the realization of this mystic power of non-doing, I walk, sit, and lie down in the sky, disappear and appear, produce smoke and flame. Being one, I become many. Being many, I become one. I become now visible, now invisible. I go through walls unhindered, as through empty space. Whatever beings I see, small or large, underdeveloped or well-developed, happy or unhappy, I adopt a corresponding physical form in order to guide them to maturity and perfection in the appropriate time. So how's that for imagination? So this probably sounds a little bit irrelevant to our daily lives if we assume that this is a bodhisattva who has attained supernatural powers. But thinking more symbolically, and think about non-obstructed in service, maybe able to freely and physically come and go and take whatever form is needed, to do whatever is needed. So maybe, this involves a physical ability to perform tasks or endure things that other people find quite amazing. Like, let's say wildfire fighting, or being a really good nurse, showing up at all the right times with whatever is needed, taking whatever role is needed most at that moment. You know, in the case of a nurse, right? Maybe sometimes it's firm medical guidance, get back in bed. Maybe it's a shoulder to cry on. Maybe it's a silent witness. Maybe it's bringing hot tea. So some questions. Are you naturally rather brave and willing, physically, mentally, or emotionally, to go wherever you see need, whenever you see it? Are you able to pretty easily set aside consideration for your own comfort in order to take care of others? If you see other people in need, that your own kind of self-interest for your own comfort recedes quickly. Are you able to change up your appearance or attitude or approach fairly easily when the situation calls for it, rather than being attached to how you think you should be or can be or are? So leave a little space there.
So I may derail the whole thing by asking this question first, but you know, the Bodhisattva overthinking things is very well aware of the risks of overthinking things. But when I hear that description, my first reaction is, what else is there? If you've got all that, what else is there? How is that a Bodhisattva and not a Buddha?
Oh, this ability to go everywhere and do everything. That's a good question. I mean, I guess when I think about, you know, these first few bodhisattvas in particular are like kind of superpower bodhisattvas. We do get to ones later on that are a little more specialized. But I guess it's the emphasis. You know, this occurs to me that this is a little bit like the bodhisattva Samantabhadra, where there's the emphasis on, I know, so if the first monk had kind of this universal vision and perspective, and almost might be like the Bodhisattva Manjushri, wisdom, stillness, and perspective. And if the second one is kind of discerning, and this one is like, this one's getting out there, this one's functioning, this one, because it describes like physically this bodhisattva like cruises the universe and, you know, goes through walls and does whatever is necessary to respond. So it feels like there's a real physical functioning action emphasis to this bodhisattva to me. Amanda?
Gosh, yeah. That's a really on the nose question. I like that, Mark, but it makes me wonder if I haven't misunderstood the difference between a bodhisattva and a Buddha the whole time. And I was wondering if you could clarify that.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's pretty, it's all kind of mythological and subtle in a way, but technically, and actually one of the chapters that I covered in preparation for this, there's a Sudana asks one of the bodhisattvas, who said, you know, so how long is it going to take you to attain Buddhahood? And she explains the bodhisattva's vow is like, I'm going to keep working on this until every last being is saved. And of course, in the Avatamsaka Sutra, that's not a matter of one sentence. That's a matter of like three pages of going on and saying, like all beings in 10 world systems, all beings in 100 world systems, all being in 100 million world systems, you know, demonstrating how much work the bodhisattva has to do. So, you know, the Buddhahood at the end of that, I guess in a way that's just another imaginative ideal that like there is this point of perfection of this, you know, absolute like, and a Buddha also is characterized as being a master teacher. So, I mean, technically, technically in the old imagery, seeing as we're, you know, this is all imaginative imagery anyway, right? The bodhisattva has vowed to be reborn in that cycle of rebirth for as many times as it takes for all beings to be freed. Whereas the Buddha, because of their complete liberation, is no longer part of that cycle at all. So, I mean, ultimately, when you're talking about these super archetypal bodhisattvas, and then you're talking about the fact that Buddhas kind of exist outside space and time anyway, then the distinctions get a little vague.
Thank you for your helpful and enjoyable explanation. Sure. I appreciate that.
So, any more reflections or thoughts on the bodhisattva who can move through walls, take whatever form, respond in that really physical and practical way?
Could I just, it's Joan, could I just add that I believe there is a gray area because, for example, Avalokiteshvara is considered to be the Buddha of compassion. So there's the, they kind of, you know, it kind of mixes things up. Thanks.
Yeah.
Domio, would you read, it was something at the end about like this bodhisattva kind of shape shifting.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to respond to it, but I couldn't quite remember what it was.
So being one, I become many. Being many, I become one. I become now visible, now invisible. I go through walls unhindered, as through empty space. Whatever beings I see, small or large, underdeveloped or well-developed, happy or unhappy, I adopt a corresponding physical form in order to guide them to maturity and perfection in the appropriate time.
Yeah, I guess that made me think about how, and this has been mentioned by a couple of people already, is that depending on the situation or the relationship, it can kind of call out different qualities from you. And you can kind of become a different person in a given situation based on the interaction. So, with some friends, I'm the calm one and that's needed. But then with other friends, I feel like I'm, neurotic by comparison. And what's needed from me is to, as you were saying, like solve the problem or be discerning about if you're feeling this way, maybe we could investigate the reasons why, or if there's a logistical problem. So this is kind of like, for me, it's a willingness to let go of self and to just be willing to be a different person based on the situation, and to sort of let go of that. I guess there's a certain pride in wanting to be the same thing from relationship to relationship and identifying with who you think you are. Mm. So that shape, I don't know if that's what that shape shifting allegory is meant to evoke, but that's what it evoked for me.
Yeah, for me too. Yeah, letting go of that sense of self, and I think that is a really profound thing to contemplate there, because we walk around with such a sense of who we are and what I'm good at and what my obligation is, and so there's so many constraints on the kind of response that I might give to a situation. And yet, yeah, if I'm really, really free and open, and it occurs to me that you make me think of this. Out in front of my house is a really busy street. It's only two lanes, but it's got a lot of traffic on it, and it's not infrequent to have little accidents out there. And I was outside and a kid was riding his bike and somebody ended up turning it. And it wasn't a bad accident, but it, they hit him and it looked like he kind of dislocated his knee and he was sitting in the road. And like, I am not, hugging does not come naturally to me. I came from the Midwest, you kind of like, even warm family members go, like it's not, I'm not a real physically demonstrative person. But it just, it was like no question that I just needed to go up and just put my arms around him, Like the poor kid was so scared and in pain, and it was just like, see, that's what I feel like, that kind of, when the self is out of the way, that kind of bodhisattva response can come. That is very natural, and it's not a matter of like standing on the sidelines and going, what noble bodhisattva act could I do in this situation? it just comes naturally if we're out of the way. Other thoughts or comments?
The feeling that I get from these really wild sutras, at first it's just like, okay, I start to think about it and maybe try and figure it out. But I end up with just, you know, this is just so wild that I'm not even going to try to figure it out. I'm just going to, you know, it's coming in, it'll be there, and we'll see how it manifests later. But
I actually,
at first, I'm resistant to that. It's like, I want answers. And by the end, I'm like, you know, this feels kind of good. I can just relax. And when we're done, I'm going to go for a run.
So. Nice. Yeah, I think that's a, you know, there's different ways to engage this stuff. And I know for me, I've appreciated trying my hand at interpretation of this kind of thing and of Dogen's writings, because guess what it does for me is, you know, once I realize, oh, that might be referring to this thing, which I really do actually have some experience in, for me, it makes that connection between, you know, this is talking about my life. This is like, it's not just like gobbledygook foreign language, you know, from outer space kind of stuff. Like it does apply. It's our real lives that are reflected in this. But I also don't know that, like you said, I don't think that's the main purpose of these writings, including Dogen. I don't think the purpose is to sit and, you know, diagram the sentences and figure out, you know, what this refers to and that refers to and this refers to. That, you know, that's why, I mean, I could have done just a talk, right? I could have just done a talk on like, well, there's lots of different ways you can be bodhisattvas, and you could be a bodhisattva by, like, you know, giving up yourself and responding appropriately in circumstances. And, you know, we could all have talked about that. But when I talk about, you know, I can go through walls and, you know, shape shift, and it speaks to us at a different level. I think you're right. That's why, you know, my one of my favorite practices was just, you know, reading the Avatamsaka out loud with other people, and not, you know, trying to talk about what it meant, but just listening to that. All right. Any last comments or questions before we wrap it up? All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye. See you tomorrow.
And thanks for the card, Candace.